When there was a desire to perceive the physical characteristics of matter, such as softness, hardness, warmth, cold, lightness, and heaviness, the background of sensation, the skin pores, the hairs on the body, and their controlling deities, the trees, were generated. Within and outside the skin is a covering of air, which sense perception became prominent. Okay, so this, of course, is going on with the description of the production from Mahavishnu of the adiatmic person, the adibhautic person, the adidaivic person. So for each adibhautic person, you know, the sense object, the trees or something, and then the sense of touch, and then the deities, actually whatever is being experienced, and the predominating deity, and the person who is, of course, enjoying all this or experiencing all this, are being described one after another. So again, like we were discussing last week with Vindaloria, it's a very, very practical, you know, description of how the world works. And from these, you can generate music, architecture, food, even mystical weapons, you know, to defend yourself. So it's very effective. It's not that it's primitive in any sense, but it's much more practical and human, you know, personal. You can deal with it in a very simple sense like that. So some points here, I think if we go ahead to slide number 5. Okay. And we have marked down here, it seems that we're going to see that there are two kinds of skin. The word skin is being used in two terms. So in 2.10.31, we're going to see Twak Charama Mangsa Rudira Nedo Majasti Dha Tabaha Bumiap Tejo Maya Shapta Prano Vyo Mambu Vayubahi. So the word by word meaning here is, says Twak, the thin layer on the skin, and charma is called the skin. You know? So it seems that what we're talking about in this whole description, one thing we're talking about is the structural skin, which kind of holds everything in the bag. And if you've ever done any kind of cut leather on an animal or done any surgery on mammals, you know that the skin is pretty tough to cut. You've got to have a real sharp scalpel, and you've got to take a real strong, you know, what do you call it, pressure, and just go for it, you know, like that and so on. And so you can open the thing up. So this is the charma. Charma is pretty tough, you know, tough stuff to keep it all in the bag. But then the tvak is the thin layer of the skin, and that's the perceiving skin, you know. And so it also describes that there's considered that to be the network of what do you call it, of axons and dendrites and tactile sense receptors. You know, from their visual point of view, you get these nerve cells, the body of the thing, pretty much as I'm remembering when I learned it. It exists back in the spinal column, you know, and they come together in different ganglia. Different nexuses like that, plexuses. And then right at that point, there can be some control over reflexes. Rather than have, the sensation of your finger being burned, go all the way up the axon, you know, the cable, and get to the nerve cell, and then be generated to another nerve cell, go back up to the brain, or to go all the way back up the spinal column to the brain, you know, which by that time your finger may actually be burned. Some of these, reflex reactions occur right in the spinal column. So right at that point, a very high frequency signal from the axon will be a little processor there, will automatically send a signal to the retraction muscles in the arm and call it just to go back. Even when frogs have no brains, if you put acid on their right chest, their right leg will come up and try and wipe it off. It's amazing. So much of the body is just a machine, you know, but it's a very interesting machine. You know? So way down at the motor, at the weight perception, you know, weight perception, what are you talking about here? Talking about sensation at the beginning, that you put some pressure on the skin, and that puts pressure on the nerve endings, the nerve cells, maybe in the spine, and the axon's a long cable with some fluid inside of it that goes all the way down to the skin, and then at the end is a sensor. Okay, so if I put some pressure on the skin, that's going to put pressure on the sensor at the end of the axon, and it's not amplitude modulated. It doesn't matter how much pressure I put on it. It's not going to send a more intense signal. What it does is sends a more frequent signal. So it's actually, your body is actually FM, not AM. frequency modulated. So then along the lining of the axon, there's like something like, sodium, potassium, or something like that, some weird thing. But it's actually kind of electrically charged. So those chemicals, when you press the guy at the end, that shoots one positive charge and negative charge, which then goes like the domino effect down all the chemicals. So actually, it's a chemical reaction. It's not a, in some ways, not exactly electrical reaction, like a cable, electrical cable. And so it goes down there, blah 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 blah. And of course it's going blah 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 blah. If you squeeze it more, it's going. Okay. So that's what it looks like from Western science. And of course we know it's a big network. A big network of sensors. You take a little needle and touch, can you feel that? Does it feel different? And then they go and they discriminate that in some areas the sensors are far apart, some they're close together. Of course, human being has a lot of nerves in the lips like that, and the tongue and stuff, for feeling these touch sensations. But other places like on the arm, forearms and stuff, not much, So that's supposed to be what the betas are looking at, as a talk, as this kind of network of skin, of touch perception. Then, of course, also we know that if I take a pair of tweezers and I take any hair on your body, if I can isolate it and pull on it, you're going to feel it in the immediate reaction. So and of course, if some wind is blowing over the skin or it's being brushed by something, of course that stimulates those nerve endings in each hair like that. So the skin also becomes another kind of sense perception dude. Not just pressure on the skin, but even just stimulating the hair, And of course kitty cats have big long whiskers. They can move around in the dark and feel like, you can imagine what it's like having whiskers like that sticking out, no? And moving from here and there and brushing against grass or different things like that. If you cut a kitty cat's whiskers off, I guess he'll go back. Yeah. But he'll be listless. He'll be kind of like spaced out, So you're getting a lot of radiation, maybe even other kinds of radiation. They may even respond to sound vibration. There's a book called Acoustical Sense in Animals. It's very nice. It's simple to read. And it's interesting because as a devotee, then you see, oh my God, this is all the different species of life, And one kind of moth, the only acoustical sense they have is they have two hairs sticking out on each side of their head, two different, densities, each one. And one responds, and they both respond to the same frequency. And that's the frequency that bats make when they're hunting, beep, 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 whatever it is. And so it's just the right size and everything else to resonate with that. And one of the cells is very dull, and one of them is very alert. So if the bat is far away, the alert one starts kicking in, and it says, hey, there's a bat there, So automatically it makes his rudder flip, and he heads the opposite way away from the sound. But the dull one, if it starts kicking in, then it means the bat's close, and there's a totally erratic diving pattern to get down to the ground as fast as possible and, become invisible. So they have these hairs responding to sound, and who knows how cats, with their sense of perception, if they're perceiving actually subtle sound vibrations by their whiskers, You can feel. One of our devotees, she was deaf from birth, but she said she used to feel the kirtan through her feet. I started looking at it, thinking about it, and I could see, when the drum is going and stuff like that, you can actually feel the kirtan through your feet. So we have these bodies, and they can perceive so many things, the tvak, the charama, you know, like that. And very nice description, of course, here of how it's going on like that, you know. And it gives an overview, it describes all the senses, you know. It describes all the senses, you know. And how they even coordinated together and stuff like that, and the deities which relate to them. I don't know if it says it here or not. Okay, so the purport will go on. Okay, I'll finish this point. And it's also describing that there's a flow of air, you know, within the skin and without the skin. Now, this, of course, is, again, where, you know, Western people, you just say that these guys are very primitive. They don't know anything, you know. So the word that is being translated as air or prana, it doesn't mean the same thing as our Western idea of air, of course, you know. It means tactile flow of energy. So the prana is moving through these axons. Actually, you can look at it that way, of a flow of energy. So this prana is flowing within the skin, but also says it's flowing without, you know, for sense perception. And this is kind of interesting because when I was studying for this black belt thing, you're supposed to be able to, you know, shoot prana out of your fingers, and it's not having very, you know, pragmatic techniques for training you. And I just went to first degree black belt, but after that you're supposed to learn more, you know, subtle tricks and stuff, you know. And so, for example, one of the first things you do is you get like an electric fry pan and put some sand into it. Then without touching the sand, you just pass your hands right over the electric fry pan and back. And, of course, there's waves of invisible prana coming off. And those waves are trying to tear up the prana in your body, you know, tear it open, you know, manipulate it. So the first time you do it, it's maybe you can't even come back. You know, and you learn just by practicing how to concentrate the prana like that. You know, and so then of course, you know, then when you're hitting people or trying to punch through boards and stuff, you learn, you know, how to concentrate the prana. So also, I had a cat. His name was Mr. Cat. Unusual fellow, but I think I mentioned this before. He was sitting there, and I was facing away from me, and I was trying to pass my hands above his body and shoot prana at him. And he felt it. He turned around and grabbed my hand and bit it, you know, irritated kind of like that, you know. So I kind of waited some time. I did it again, and he couldn't see me, you know. And the second time, he turned around and bit me harder and ran away. So it was irritating. It wasn't touching him. You know, so heat and cold, you know, and hard and soft. These are the symptoms of prana. So, for example, I'm sitting on a desk. I sit on the desk that way my feet don't swell up. I look out the window here. Is there prana in the desk? You know, well, yes, but it's all in balance. You know, if you don't think there is any, just try and pull it apart. You see, there's tremendous tactile force there. You know, but it's all equally, totally balanced. You know, it's in a static form, and of course, then we can release it by doing things like, you know, heating it up, and at a certain point, of course, the prana will come out, and the heart. So that's the symptoms of prana. Wherever there's hardness and softness, or heat and cold, there's prana. And of course, in our body, it's circulating. We've got the different chakras; they're very famous. And a candle is also moving. You know, in a river, it's moving. So forget about what you see. Just focus on what you feel. You know? Imagine that you've, for example, been blind from birth. You know, and so you can see, like, really imagine it. You know, all the things around you, as you see, like I see my bookcase with a picture of Prabhupada, Radha Krishna, different books, you know, the window. But I wouldn't be able to see those. You know? But I could experience them by touching them and feeling them and understand, you know, develop an idea, well, this is a square. You know, squares fit together, circles and squares don't fit together, you know. So we develop a whole, you know, Euclidean geometry, which is popular in our culture, like that, and a whole, you know, space perception, but it's all based on touch. And of course, why not expect that such people can develop very, very fine sense of touch, you know, and experience very, very subtle things that we people who rely on vision don't pick up so much. You know? So the whole, you know, different way of perception is actually subtler. You know, again, vision is about one-third the speed of touch, and touch is about one-third the speed of sound, like that. So sound is the finest form, and then it expands out like that. So anyway, right now it's beginning, I guess, I don't know, I guess it was given before, maybe not, but at least now it's being given. I think it was, we went through one time before, I think, through the deities and the elements, like that. And the third canto, of course, Maitreya will go through it again, and then Kapila will go through it. And that's pretty much about the last time it will be described in this very, you know, detailed form in terms of the elements and their deities and how they interact like that and so on. So this tactile, you know, the flowing of air outside the skin is also there apparently. And how Western science would perceive it and stuff like that, I don't know exactly. You know, I know sharks are supposedly generate like electricity right near their body, and they're sensitive to that. So they have, once they home in on something, they get within a certain distance and they lock it on electronically. They get electronic lock on. It's amazing. You know, animals are all, you know, how animals have all developed by chance. Like that. Okay. Let's go to the slideshow again here. If we go to number 6, and Prabhupada's purport, the physical characteristics of matter, such as softness, are subjects of sense perception, and thus physical knowledge is the subject matter of the touch sensation. One can measure the temperature of matter by touching it with the hand, and one can measure the weight of an object by lifting it with the hand, and thus estimate its heaviness or lightness. Next slide. The skin pores, and the hairs on the body are all interdependent with the touch sensation. The skin pores, and the hairs in the body. The air blowing within and outside the skin is also an object of sense perception. This sense perception is also a source of knowledge. And therefore, it is suggested here that physical or physiological knowledge is subordinate to the knowledge of the self, as above mentioned. Knowledge of self can expand to knowledge of phenomena, but physical knowledge cannot lead to knowledge of the self. And last slide, number 8. There is, however, an intimate relation between the hairs on the body and the vegetation on the body of the earth. The vegetables are nourishment for the skin, both as food and medicine, as stated in the third canto. Twacham asya vinir binam divishur dishnam oshadaha. And of course, it's just a fact, you know, that if we have like that nice, very nice herbs, you know, we feel that there's such a nutritional value. And of course, it may not be like oil. Oil, of course, we can digest for a lot of prana, get a lot of prana out of it. But the big variety of fresh herbs, you know, then of course it's very, very good here for the skin and for the sense perception, for the eyes, and so many things like that. You know? So pretty much that's our presentation here. It's a very simple verse. Does anybody else have any questions or comments then?
Maharaj, you have to give me a moment to mute everybody.
Okay.
I have a question.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
Okay, so thank you for this detailed explanation. Please accept my obeisances. I was just looking at the show yesterday on the television, and you know, the yogi Swami Ramdev, he's actually invited some person who is training people to see with the blindfold. So
yeah.
I put that show on my Facebook. It's far out. It actually just shows exactly what you were saying. Even they could read with the thumb, you know, the toe actually, the big toe, and the explanation given by the teacher who's actually teaching them is clearing the pineal gland. So once the decalcification happens in the pineal gland, then there was this young kids, they've been given a training just within 2 days, they're beginning to see with complete blindfold, but they have to bring it close to their forehead, touch and smell. They were using their smell. But the 13-year-old girl who's got 2 months training, she was reading any material you give, small print, large, fine print, everything. And, I mean, we would think it was quite amazing, but this person who is doing it actually, obviously, I mean, whatever Swami Ramdev does, they have a scientific backing behind that. So they were explaining about through the pineal gland, and on the toe also is the point or the reflexology of the pineal. So,
I was in Mexico. I was in Mexico a long time ago, maybe even 20 years ago, when I first started going there. And devotees took us to this one rich lady's house in Mexico City. And she had a big, you know, big property, big house. And she had 5 German shepherds, you know, that kind of roamed around at night. And each one had an old little house side by side with their name on it. And they were all sitting there. And they weren't vicious. They were kind of like just chained up and just saying hello to us. But then the person who kind of ran the property for her, he was doing the same thing. He said that they learned it when some like Sikh fellow had come like maybe 5 years before and had been training them, and especially the children could pick it up. And then he had showed me one of the children. He blindfolded them. And they were blindfolded because sometimes you look out of the bottom of the blindfold, but they weren't doing that. No. Then he had me pick out from just some newspapers there. One, and then the child passed a hand over, and without touching it, was able. But they weren't doing fine print. They were just doing like titles and stuff like that. But what they were doing though was they were hypnotizing rabbits with their hands. They would blindfolded have a rabbit there, and they would just do the prana thing, and they showed the rabbits would just like, you know, become anesthetized like that, so on. Yeah, so. Yeah, so it's all this stuff is possible, and it's for free, relatively speaking. And also, a lot of it, like you're saying, though, this is a fact, it seems like a lot of it requires that people start training at a young age. In older age, yeah, but a young age. And he was even saying that some people, as he grew up, they would lose the ability. You know, so younger children, they're learning it, and also they keep a lifestyle and keep a pure lifestyle in terms of brahmacharya and that kind of stuff, you know. But, yeah, so many simpler ways to do things than we're doing them.
Yeah, actually, because they've got the science down, so they have a 3-month course, and they're actually using music, sound, smell, touch, other senses. But like you said, yes, they start off with the young kids, it's much easier. But because they have got the science down to the T, so gradually they're bringing other people, but they have to unlearn their habits.
Oh, yeah. And also, too, if you've been engaging in so much illicit sex and eating heavy foods, you know, for 30 years, there's a good chance you don't have the sensitivity. Your pineal gland, that kind of stuff, is so crustified, you're not going to be able to, you know, bring it back. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Makes me kind of think of almost some reflection of, in the Brahma Samhita, Angani Jasya Sakalendriya Vrittimanti, that in the spiritual body, any one of the senses can perform the function of any other sense. You know, you could spiritually, you know, see through your skin and so on. Maybe that's some reflection. I was wondering if they were able to give vision to though anyone who was blind, who was totally blind from birth, if they could be trained to see.
Yes, that's what they're doing, actually. That's what
they're
doing. Because what they're trying to do is use the pineal gland, and the girl was saying, she's a 13-year-old girl, she was saying, I can see it as if I have eyes in one sense. There's no difference because the pineal gland, he said, it's almost like the third eye is open.
Interesting.
And the technique they said was to use a lot of music and sound, and smell perception, so they actually enliven other senses. It's not necessary to do all the other mode of goodness activities, but just by clearing the pineal gland, they were able to do. So anyway, we're going to hear about it soon because this is going to go out. And, you know, the science will be known. But I think the pranayama is very, very important. They use the breath control. Just like in these words, they're talking about the prana or the air, the movement of the air. So that's very much important.
When we engage in chanting and dancing properly, and when you try and, you know, to chant with an open throat and express yourself properly, you know, then automatically, you know, the pranayama and everything else becomes developed. And automatically you start to develop all these different abilities like that. Again, this deaf lady, Daya, she was saying that she was telling all her friends to become devotees because automatically, you know, she was getting so much sensitivity and everything else like that without having to do different techniques.
There was something I wanted to ask about in the translation, but it's not up on the screen. Could you put that back up again? Some reference to something like the trees, trees being deities.
Yeah, where is it here? Mahi Ruhaha. Mahi Ruhaha. As well as the trees, the controlling deities.
So what's being said deities. There?
I don't know exactly. I tried to go through this word-by-word thing with our Sanskrit, German thing, Deutschland. But I also was wondering about that, you know, if I could find out what Ruha means or something like that. Mahi, Mahima. Yeah. Something more like the deities, you know, what is it? I think Soma. Soma is the also the deity for the trees and the herbs and that kind of thing too. So maybe it indirectly refers to him. Ruhu. So there's some work there to do. That's even like I go through these verses, I'm trying to memorize the verses and the word-by-word meanings. And when I go out from our walk in the evening with the Tagore Sundar, he's a psychiatrist, he's from India, and I'm kind of going through it, and he just knows it naturally because it's so close to Hindi so many times like that, you know. And so the same way as the Prabhupada, my goodness, you know, his intelligence and everything else, I think it was difficult for him to always remember he had to come down to our level, you know, to get the point across. Yeah. And so but the Bhagavatam, again, it presents it again and again and again and again, you know. And so each time you go through it, you see a little different angle. It gets a little better, as I'm seeing. And of course, we use this. Again, we use this in chanting and dancing. You can, you know, chant and dance properly, everything else like that, you know. And pure, like you're saying, it does, you know. When we take a cold bath or a cooling bath, yeah, the bath cleans the skin off externally, but a lot of it is actually the massage. And if you're taking a cooling bath, you know, three times a day, of course, it cools down the blood, it cools down the fat, it cools down the muscle. Then automatically all the prana, you know, all the fluids, they all go back inside the internal organs where they can become, you know, purified, cleaned up. And it gives all this energy back, of course, to your head, your brain, you know. So bathing and everything else three times a day like that, it does so much, you know, for generating all these energies like that. We're still doing this work with Carl Jung, and we're getting more and more people. And again, I think I told you that in South America, we're going back again for the second time with this sweep on this. And it's a fact now. People are coming back who were first time. And in Cordoba, in northern Argentina, they have some, they have one contact with one professor So with her, they started getting the hall, the university, everything else. And they said, well, you know, we're going to be there in about 2 weeks, or 2 weeks, a little more. And they said the hall they have holds with 70 people, and they've already sold 60 tickets like that. 60 registrations already sold out. So there's no question I'm not going to sell the last of them. And 10 of those are professors like that, or professional psychotherapists. And then one of them actually has a course, a graduate course on Carl Jung. So he has 10 graduate students that are coming, you know. And, of course, this will be a little intimidating for us. But we're actually reading. And it's very natural for us. I mean, like the ideas, the concepts, you know, it's our nature. And so we actually feel, like, confident now that we know a good level of actual familiarity with Carl Jung and his ideas and how they were developing. And it's not just him in this whole process like that, like, you know, the yogis developing these abilities. Of course, some of these things, even in the Patanjali systems and so on, they're passed down. You know, training is passed down. But then it's a fact that the acharyas, and they just investigate. The super soul rewards them, gives them hints, you know. And they experience different things, you know. And so then they begin to develop more of an awareness. There's two videos. I think it's maybe it's one video which was edited two different ways on the internet of an interview with Carl Jung. Maybe two different ones. And it's just extremely interesting, the person, for me, but I think for a lot of people too.
Maharaj, would you summarize for us the sort of the essence of Carl Jung's philosophy? I know you've touched upon it here.
I can't. If you look at his biography, his autobiography, it's very easy to read. That's the point, is that, you know, he himself said he was trying to understand what was going on. And he came from a tradition in the West where people were trying to understand what was going on. There's this comment that there was no introspective reality until the time of Hamlet. That before that, people just lived in a totally karma-based world. They would just do things without ever reflecting on themselves. Eat meat, live in the icy cold weather of Germany, you know. And how true it is. But then Shakespeare was the first person who had a player who really started to think about things. You know, is it right? Is it wrong? You know? So it went on down through different people, and Kant, and then Nietzsche. So Carl Jung bumped into it about 1890, when probably 1870. Well, yeah, maybe before that, even maybe about 1830. So very nice going back, and they were just trying to figure out what's going on. And they were beginning to deal with people who were crazy, you know, extreme cases of mental functioning, and sometimes, of course, with people with super mental functioning. And some of them, of course, like Jung, were having experiences, you know, very strong experiences, which they had no way to sort them out. So they started speculating, and the speculation was based upon the fact that it's all coming from the body, the genes develop this and that, and, you know, then on and on, like you can see, very primitive even in terms of the physical knowledge, and different theories, and they would argue libido and psychoid and go back and forth. So even Jung, his philosophy, he redeveloped it. And that's what's nice about him and about his followers, is he was the first principle of acquiring knowledge is humility. And he really had that to a large degree. And you can see that Jung's followers apparently, and Jung were quite, what's the word, like antagonistic towards, Freud's followers. Freud's followers, when Jung left, there was this real hostility, acrimonious feeling, which you can see that Jung never, ever felt that towards them, you know. He really had real humility and respect for other people's good qualities. So it makes, thank you for talking about this, because it gives me a chance to organize these things. So that's what I would say, one of the foremost things that we're finding in the community. Here's a community where the acharya was humble, had a sense of humor, and also was very, very pragmatic. Because he thought Nietzsche was heading the right direction, but he didn't have a good grounding, and so he went mad. You know, so like the syphilis also helped too. You know, but before that even. So Jung would take a break. He'd do his introspective techniques. So he would do his technique was, he did the free association tests. He'd give us words, and you get responses. And of course, if you do these with a group of people together, it's very embarrassing. And I have the words on the screen and say, okay, well, we see the word, the first thing that comes into your mind, like that. So you go water, air, tree, house, wife, of course. Yeah, the first word that comes into your mouth and you say the word wife, if you're not restraining it, may be embarrassing like that. So we don't have anybody do it in embarrassing. But they were using those techniques. They were using, what else to call it, different things like that, you know. So they actually had some techniques, some yoga, some ways to getting into the subconscious. So to summarize it, his philosophy at that time, which he was a part of a community, he was very much a leader in the development of different philosophers. William James was his good friend. Was that there is a subconscious. Before this, nobody even thought about that. You know, we as growing up in the whole hippie world got this from Jung, you know, and why Prabhu was able to capitalize on it. Yes, there is a part of our consciousness which is we're not aware of, you know. And if we're really gross, we're just absorbing the sense objects. A little bit subtler, we come back to the senses. A little more subtle, we come back to the mind. A little more subtle, we come back to the Buddha, Buddhi. And we can actually see how our intelligence is always, you know, adjusting the perspective on things that we think about. So that's where they were, and they accepted it was an unconscious. Some people thought the unconscious was coming out of matter, was generated by evolution. It was very simple, gross things, you know. But he was saying, no, there's so many subtle things there. And he was actually saying the subconscious actually can just take charge of us. It actually is a living force. So there was seems like we're coming in contact with the Paramatma, the Hiranyagarbha, the Virat Roop. So that was about his level of realization, was that there's a real subtle force there which really generates our external thoughts and sense perceptions and understandings of things. And he saw that it was the same all over the world. He saw totally isolated cultures which had the same, you know, subtle perception of how reality is and how things work and divisions like that, which would take us into Varna Ashram that we've seen and things like that and so on. And then he got into introspective, what he's famous for is introvert and extrovert. He invented those words, which I think we use. And he would just say that some people are conscious of what's happening inside themselves, and other people always just base their life on what's happening externally, like that, and so on. You know. And a few more things, but they're kind of like this, it's just like that. They're kind of like disconnected. You know, each one is kind of true in his little group. And that's where he was at, you know. But he could actually deal with his patients, get them to get in touch with their subtler motivations and feelings through art, especially through art, drawing, through visual arts, you know, and through dreams, you know. And then they would start to, you know, reconcile their external world with what actually was motivating them internally. And they could cure themselves from very, very serious, you know, neuroses, you know, compulsions and problems they had like that. Some very serious problems, even psychotics. He could cure them. You know? So that's about basically it. He accepted the unconscious and began to see how powerful it was, how all-pervasive it was, and how it actually had force over us. And he began to develop techniques for dealing with it. And he also kept a whole thing of moral responsibility, a very big aspect. Other people were saying, well, there's nobody, you're not responsible. You're not responsible. But pretty much the whole thing, he was saying, no. You are responsible. I'll just mention one case. One person was having always, I think, skin diseases and everything else. And he came to Jung. And then he submitted to Jung this whole psychoanalytical thing of his dreams and everything else. And Jung said it was such a, he was an intelligent person, you know. It was such an accurate thing. It could have been published in Freud's journal. He said it was such a perfect analysis, you know. But it didn't get rid of the disease. So then he went on and started talking to the guy. And it turns out he was living on the Riviera and wasn't working. And he asked, well, how is this possible? And he said, well, I have an arrangement with one lady, and she appreciates my work, and she pays me. So he went on into that a little bit. And apparently he was like maybe about 30, and this woman was like 41, single, And she developed a whole, you know, emotional crush on him and everything else like that. And she was a teacher. And she was using all of her income, living almost in poverty, and giving her income so he could live like a playboy, not a playboy, but so he could live in ease on the Riviera while she worked in the school in Germany. And so Jung just tore into the guy and said, you have this disease as a punishment for what you're doing to this woman, how you're exploiting her emotional attachment to you. You're living like a pig at her expense, and you're not going to get free from this skin disease until you admit this and take responsibility for your moral abuses like that. So the guy didn't accept it and said he was a moralist and so on. But that's kind of a summary. That's okay?
Would you mind, because you just gave us this wonderful summary, would you mind briefly summarizing sort of the gist of what your presentation will be? And is there a title to your presentation?
That's why I say I'm so happy to talk about this. We're doing different presentations, different places. Out of all the people in ISKCON who so far who've been here, I've talked to about this, the only person who was really enthusiastic about it, I mean, some people too, even my manager here was talking about it, but I mean, like, just passionate was Bhakti Vignaswami in Russia, Vignaswami. And we had some contact, we get along. So I just saw him in passing in Mayapur, and he said, hello, what are you doing, And I mentioned Jung, and he said, oh, yes, go on. He said, Jung is so important for our preaching. Okay. So I think maybe for our preaching, maybe he meant his and mine. Or some people too, but he it is, a lot of people have some contact. So a lot of what we do in the programs like that is actually just familiarize people who don't know Jung at all. You know, we have a slideshow, we just introduce his ideas and stuff like that so they can appreciate the general perspective like that. You know? And then it's the whole point, like, as we're starting to penetrate, then we're starting to get people who have more and more intense experiences. In South America, psychology tends to be a ladies' profession. In the United States and California, it was like 50-50. And so I went to a psychology presentation when I was the first time in South America, and I had all this like logical, rational thing built up about Sankhya. And I went in there and looked at it, and there was like maybe 250 students there, and five men, the entire thing. 245 women. The dean was a woman. So I almost kind of like tossed my notes over my shoulders and just started telling stories, you know. And okay, yeah, from the story you can get the point and you'll remember it, you know. So generally speaking, as a general principle, you know, ladies understand that way, from stories and personal relations in that sense. So that's one thing we're doing. And then it depends on the kind of audience. That's why I'm asking them what kind of people we have. Because I don't know, and talking it over with you all, this 2-minute presentation I just made was so wonderful for me to get into hierarchies down there like that. But other than that, because see, what will happen is that they start asking technical questions about transference and neurosis and things like that, which I have some background, you know. And it stimulates you, you know, to put things in perspective and to remember them and stuff like that. So more what we're doing is kind of like that. It's more improvisational at this point, developing. And then I want to go farther, but in many cases, they're only capable of going to the level of Virat Roop, you know, and then the hierarchy of the elements is something very, very... One program with the architects, graduate students of architecture, after I did the whole presentation in the Sankhya, we're having prasadam at the end of the third session, the third evening. And the dean just stopped everybody suddenly with this realization, and he said, so what you're telling me is I'm not these eyes, I'm these ears. Oh, my God, yeah.
How do you plan to use this presentation as a platform to sort of bridge people to Krishna consciousness, to present? How do you plan to present or work our philosophy into this? Because obviously we're... Nor our purpose is not to go there and teach Jung's philosophy, because number one, we're not really ultimately experts in it, and ultimately have no interest in it. Ultimately, so obviously your intent is to somehow infiltrate those interested in Jung and plant the seed of Krishna consciousness in them. So how do you plan to do that?
No, because like I was saying, it's you know, if you try and preach to a dog during the Sunday feast, you're not going to get very far. You know, just like that. You can give him prasadam, that's about all he can handle, you know. But somebody else, you feel like this guy's pretty dull and you just can't appreciate much, you know. So these people are already, what to speak of the yogi, what to speak of the pious and this and that. They're already on a platform where they're honest or they're self-respective. And so what happens, for example, that the what is it called? The mental health center in Argentina. We get his presentation, and they animated them much more. They wanted to hear more, and some of them stayed after, and some of them came to the temple after like that. Specifically, one lady, we had a four-day program. She came the first day to the general program. She came the second day to the third program. But the last day, she came to Sunday feast. She bought a set of japa beads and Prabhupada's books, and now she's, I guess, initiated devotee. So that's what it is. Some people, you know, it's progressive. Like, you know, progressive. You go through and you keep going through deeper and deeper levels in the lectures. And if you do a four-series lecture series, you can go, like, you know, all the way to inviting them to the full Sunday feast. Beyond that, we always have the book table there. And, of course, that's one of our basic techniques is, you know, say anything you want to say, but get them to buy a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So after the Jungian thing, everybody bought books. And some people were buying two, three, and, you know, almost everything we had like that and so on. So, because that's the real satisfaction. You know, the people, they buy the books with an attitude of reading them and understanding them. And you know that they have the capability, you know, of reading it like that and stuff. So that's it. Yeah.
We distribute prasadam there as well?
Oh, yeah, always, every time. Prabhupada's formula for the university preaching for the was nice reception, nice prasadam, then, you know, discuss philosophy, you know. And after that, that's about it. It was a program, yeah. So, you know, with the prasadam, it makes your brain work. Like that.
Yeah.
Brain stuff just starts working. Yeah. You're absorbing your body, and your body feels good. Your body feels invigorated, and so you can start thinking these higher thoughts, you know. The stuff for maybe like 2 hours, and it's time for the coffee break. Yeah. And also the thing is, I mean, everybody got their nature. I mean, this whole point is that Satrup Maharaj is saying, he was quoting one guy, he says, it's a big famous author, and he said, why do you write? He said, because I wasn't good for anything else. But this is my nature. This is the kind of people I can relate to. Srup Damodar Maharaj was explaining, who was that? Oh, yeah, I remember I was sitting in the Berkeley Temple in the prasadam room there, a big thing, you know. And Mother Divyadristi, this is like, I don't know, maybe 40 years ago or 30 years ago. Mother Divyadristi was sitting, like, not too far away, talking to one of the young college girls who'd come, some other she'd come. And I was finishing taking prasadam, and, just, you know, I could hear what they were saying, you know, and she was explaining the basic philosophy, you know. And the girl was listening, you know. And then she kind of came down to her closing point, you know, and she said, and you know what's really nice about Krishna consciousness? And the girl said, no, what is it? And she said that when you go out, nobody cares how your makeup's on, correct or not. And I was expecting some like really intense thing here. And the girl responded by going, wow, it was like, my goodness, you know. And I was thinking, my goodness, it must be such an absorption to have a female body. You go all the time around painting your eyebrows, curling your lashes, powdering your cheeks, you know, and you've got to keep this pretty face. If you don't do it, you know, you aren't popular. People don't deal with you. You don't get a good job. And so I can see everybody is in a different position, you know, and so the preaching means, you know, just to take whatever position you're in and then approach the people that you naturally relate to, you know.
Maharaj, Ravananda Prabhu mentioned perhaps yesterday or so that you will be traveling for some time, and we won't get the benefit of your classes until you return. Is that correct?
I think more like you have the opportunity to escape. Oh my God!
How long will you be gone?
Vamos a viajar para seis semanas in Sudamérica.
Ah, seis semanas.
We go traveling for six weeks in South America. Boy, which is better, tamales? Tamale prasadam or pizza prasadam?
Just keep
your tamales.
Just stay away from the caveat.
Yeah. Cogito. I'll eat the cogito. Cogito ergo sum.
Well, we'll miss you, Maharaj.
Well, I guess, honestly speaking, for me, it's just one of the nice points of my week. Each week is Friday. The classes are like that. And even listening to, I couldn't listen so much this week because we are packing up these last minutes. You know how it is. Six weeks gone. You know, somebody burned his motherboard out. He said, "Oh, Maharaj, it's not available in Peru. Can you get me a new motherboard?" Yeah. And this is like, you know, Christmas season, maybe 10 days before I go. You know, and sure enough, you had to send the overnight express mail to try and get the thing.
Back to your presentations. You're presenting in Spanish, in the Spanish language in South America?
Yeah, now I can talk now. I guess what it sounds like is this is pretty reasonable. I usually have somebody right there to help me with, like, you know, it would have been, you know, the future conditional.
But yes, people.
Yeah. But because if you use a translator, you have less than half, you have like half the time. Because, you know, half the time you use it up in translation. And so it's South America, it's very different. Every culture has its qualifications. And again, maybe I mentioned that one South American phrase is, los norteamericanos son muy cuadráticos, which, you know, translates basically as North Americans are blockheads, you know. And we have this kind of, you know, German square-headed way of doing things. And, you know, the shortest distance is always a straight line. And, you know, you turn directly right, you know. And so, but in Latin America, they have much more romantic, you know, sensibilities about life and stuff. And they can appreciate, you know, they say when they translate Prabhupada's books, it's a challenge because there'll be several ways in Spanish to say it, like, because it's a more religious and pious language. So you have to go back to the Sanskrit and try and find out what Prabhupada jammed down into fit into our German English, you know, and then go ahead and put it like in Spanish so it kind of expands back out again. Yeah. And I know one German told me that it's very difficult to read Prabhupada's books in German. And I mentioned that in one class, and then one very big, strong-looking, blonde-haired guy in the back was nodding his head up and down like that. Yes. German is a very analytical language, you know. And so it's like, even still, science articles are published in German and English. And diplomacy is, French is still the language of diplomacy. If you look in your passport, it will have Spanish, English, and French. All over the world, the passports are in French. Yeah. French is the language of diplomacy. Yeah. So thank you very much, and I hope you all develop your ability to read newspapers and Prabhupada's book with your big toe, like that.
That was.
And then we could actually read two books at the same time, I guess. So thank you, Mother Gandhari, everybody. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Jai. Thank you so much. Jai Shri Prabhupada.
Buen viaje.
Buen viaje.
Aloha.
Ha, 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 ha.